Our first speaker today, while currently a Coloradian, is no stranger to these parts. Born in Rockport, Maine, John Reed was brought up in New England, obtained his A.B. degree from Dartmouth College, where his early interest in botany and ecology were kindled. With us today are four emeritus professors who, to a large degree, kindled this interest. Emeritus professors Poole, Page, Wilson, and Lyon of the former botany department. And all of them are still very active in their own field of research. From Dartmouth, John Reed went to Duke University for graduate study, obtained in Duke a Master's of Arts, a PhD degree, and a wife, all from the Department of Botany, I understand. He moved through a series of teaching appointments, spending a 10-year period for the 10-year period from 1946 to 1956 at the University of Wyoming. He again came east, this time to our sister institution in New Hampshire, the University of New Hampshire in Durham, where he came as a professor of botany. And over this 6-year period, he moved up, or to retain my prerogative as a faculty member, possibly he moved down through a series of appointments from professor of botany to dean of graduate studies to vice president and acting president. 3 years ago, he left again these parts, heading west, this time to take on the major chore of president of the new institution, the Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado. Dr. Reed's national contributions to the field of ecology include, in addition to a series of papers in the field of ecology, serving as member of the National Science Foundation Program on Environmental Biology, Panel on Environmental Biology, Secretary of the Ecological Society, Chairman of the Ecological Study Committee, and more recently, President of the Ecological Society of America. It is indeed with great pleasure that I present Dr. John Reed, who will talk on the topic Ecology, the Maturing of a Discipline. Dr. Reed.
Dr. Copenhaver, Dr. Barrett, ladies and gentlemen. I could add the interesting coincidence, too, that Dr. Barrett is one of the individuals whom I came to know in my last stay in New Hampshire. We share him both at Dartmouth College and point out with real pride that he came also from the University of New Hampshire. It's a real pleasure to be back in New England, and particularly here, because the interrelationship of these two institutions, which it's been my privilege to be a part of, is a very long-standing one, and I think an increasingly close one as time goes on. In 1930, when as a sophomore at Dartmouth College, I registered for Botany 1, Dr. Wilson, Botany 2, Dr. Lyon, the Natural Science Building, which has already been alluded to, had not yet become Silsby Hall, but it was the most modern science building on the whole campus. Probably no one, in the wildest flight of his imagination, thought of anything like these laboratories and this center existing in Hanover. Ecology, the subject which I represent here today, was not recognized as a separate course at Dartmouth College in that era, but it wasn't entirely neglected either. Dr. Lyon included a great bit of basic ecology in Botany 2. So did Professor Page in Forest Botany, and Professor Griggs in his popular course in Natural History covered this, the basic fundamentals, very well. If I may be personal a moment, I would like to salute all of those biology teachers of my day here, Dr. Chivers, Dr. Wilson, Dr. Lyon, Professors Page, Griggs, Dr. Unger, Dr. Ballard of the Zoology Department, from the library then, Mr. Rugg, Professor Amsden of the Chemistry Department. These latter two gentlemen accompanied us rather regularly on all our field trips, not just as fellow travelers, but significantly. Professor Patton, Dr. Poole of the then Evolution Department, aren't to be overlooked either. These men were the teachers of 30 years ago who characterized the Dartmouth that I know and still respect most highly. They were men who inspired and taught. For many of us who went to Dartmouth, they are the epitome of what we have striven to be wherever we practiced our profession as teachers and biologists. Their interests in the Sons of Dartmouth are not transitory in the least. They have served to guide, inspire, and instruct us throughout our post-Dartmouth careers. My special task here today is to describe some of the things that are happening in ecology or environmental biology. I intend to develop my thesis on the basis of an historical approach leading up to the present state of the art, with a summary of some of the problems that it now embraces, the promise that the future holds for it. These are both important facets of this discipline. Ecology is important as man learns to manipulate his environment in order to survive. Fortunately, it was suggested that my remarks be general by comparison with those of the specific research project reports that are to follow. I appreciate this suggestion very much because my own career at the University of New Hampshire, the Fort Lewis College, over the past 9 years has precluded direct involvement in research activity. This is the fate of those that leave the classroom for the academic arena in higher education. I'll start this historical summary or resume. Perhaps it should better be thought of as the evolution of ecology, as we find it in its most primitive, earliest condition, as natural history. Natural history is basically a practical kind of subject, marking man's intelligent approach through reason to the management and exploitation of natural resources of his environment with a view to increasing his own supply of food, clothing, and safety. Collectively, it is a blend of folklore, practical knowledge, and natural history that provides the basis for modern ecology. These came from the experiences of men and women who live close to nature and develop an intense understanding of plants and animals in their native haunts. Among primitive people, the bonds between humans and their natural environmental environment are strong, were strong. Their almost innate recognition and understanding of natural phenomena is remarkable and well known. For example, it was no small cause of amazement to me and my Belgian colleagues in working with some of the more primitive people in the remote sections of Central Africa a dozen years ago, when we realized that the folks with whom we had great difficulty in communicating really appreciated the rather intricate process of local plant succession. We were surprised, and it was greatly to our advantage, that they also possessed the ability to distinguish subspecific taxa of many of the local plants, in fact, their languages, provided names, without which it would be quite impossible to work in some of the more remote parts of the world. The evolution of ecology from through the next stage really represents the application of the scientific method to natural history. Normally, this progression toward the application of the scientific method has resulted from some concern for naming organisms precisely, for describing with some precision the habitats of those organisms, and from experimenting to discover cause and effect relationships both with the organisms and the environmental factors involved. Simply put, ecology became a science first as precision was introduced into the inventory of living and non-living components of the Earth's landscape, and second, as experimental techniques were evolved which helped develop explanations why organisms are where they are and why they behave as they do. Ecology then emerged as a discipline and became something more than natural history, concurrently with the establishment of principles that resulted from field observation coupled with precise nomenclature and description plus experimentation. It's important to realize that concepts developed and appeared in this context, which could not have arisen by studying isolated individuals or by studying the physical environment alone, or even by experimenting with living organisms in a manner unrelated to what they might reasonably be expected to encounter in nature. Ecology may next be considered as having moved into its own as a distinguishable discipline when it began to assume an integrative function. There are several levels of integration discernible in the evolution of environmental biology. The first, and most obvious, recognizes that ecology derives many of its basic premises from the other subdivisions of biology: the systematist, the physiologist, pathologist, the geneticist, the morphologist, and the evolutionist provide certain basic, relatively exact facts about organisms. The ecologist starts with these and proceeds by his own field-developed and field-adapted techniques to study organisms as they behave in nature. Ecology becomes integrative in the sense that it takes minutiae from several other biological disciplines and re-relates them in explaining behavior and survival in nature. The dimension added to the contributions of most of the other biological sciences is that of field study and subsequent experimental manipulation designed to relate observed behavior to field conditions. Then it should also be recognized that ecology derives many of its techniques and principles from other sciences and other disciplines. Perhaps this level of integration is more important than the first, for herein many sciences are truly brought together in a single focus on living things. The importance of a knowledge of limiting factors in the environment of any organism is gained from basic studies in physiology. The analysis and understanding of the habitat, especially the physical factors thereof, demands the techniques and knowledge of the physicist and the chemist. The medium supporting a given organism is likely to be better understood if its geological origin is known. And the tool subjects, mathematics and language, loom particularly important in developing ideas, in expressing them clearly, and in testing the hypotheses and theories that seem to emerge as this integration of knowledge goes on in an ecological context. Ecology is an integrative discipline in still another sense as well. It is almost inevitably concerned with both the interrelatedness of organisms and the relation of those organisms to the environment which all of them share. Ecology is almost always concerned with numbers and groups. The noted British animal ecologist Dr. Charles Elton makes the point in this manner. It is frequently suggested that animal ecology can be divided into otecology, the study of a single species in all their aspects, and synecology, the study of animal communities. But it is clear that the study of the otecology of the number of any species involves inevitably a consideration of the synecology of the community in which it lives. Close quote. Thus groups become the important units of study in ecology. This is purely a result of the biological phenomenon of reproduction, because this is paramount of importance in nature. Reproduction produces numbers of individuals, each of which is the focal point of all environmental factors, and yet, simultaneously, each is also a part of the environment of all the others. Numbers of individuals produce a variety of capabilities, and thus there arises in nature social organization within groups, behavior related to groups, and competition for the basic essentials. Ecology must embrace an understanding of the dynamics of population studies, as well as the structure and nature of communities. In short, the purview of ecology evolves from a relatively simple level of observation of natural phenomena to a discipline with its own principles derived from the analysis and concern for, in the vernacular, togetherness. When the evolution of environmental biology had proceeded to the point of involvement with populations and communities, there was much research activity in phytosociology, forest type descriptions, and the descriptions of animal communities. Plant and animal geography were enriched, and among European botanists especially, elaborate systems were developed for comparing plant communities and even for establishing evolutionary, not successional, trends and lineages among communities which are actually physiognomically varied and geographically quite discontinuous. Floristics, faunistics, systematic botany, systematic zoology profited enormously from the collection of the specimens that formed the bases of these descriptive studies. A vast amount of ecological literature was published describing such communities. And perhaps the greatest contribution of these studies is that the structural and physiognomic relationship of the organisms that live together in space and time was established. These community-oriented studies really raised more questions about the fundamental reasons of why organisms occur where they do than they answered. There are very few cause and effect relationships proven conclusively by studies that stop with species lists, spatial relationships, and cartographic displays. Experimentation is difficult in this realm of community ecology insofar as learning about the basic interrelationship of individuals and species. Although countless experimental techniques have been evolved for modifying and managing forests and rangelands, the use of exclosures on the range, such silvicultural practices as thinning and selective harvesting in forestry, have taught technicians how to manage communities for specific purposes, yet told us very little about basic ecological processes and the principles involved. Population studies are another matter. Zoologists have done the significant work here. Dr. Thomas Park, the University of Chicago, a leader in this field, and many others have focused attention on the idiosyncrasies of populations, especially reproductive behavior of animal populations under laboratory conditions. From such intimate studies of populations of single species, the fundamentals of the group dynamics within communities involving interspecific behavior may be inferred. Botanists and agronomists have paid attention to population problems through their studies of yield of forage, fruit, seeds as related to spacing of plants. Dr. Frederick Clements did classic work on competition, certainly a population problem. Several workers have studied plant populations quite untraditionally by concentrating upon ecological life histories of organisms, instead of limiting themselves purely to the cytological phenomena of the germplasm. The British Journal of Ecology regularly publishes ecological life history studies in the series known as the Biological Flora of the British Isles. A still higher level of integration in ecology has been recognized in recent years with the advent of the concept of the ecosystem as the fundamental ecological unit. The ecosystem includes the biotic and abiotic components of any natural situation in inextricable interrelationship. It allows for all magnitudes of units. It opens the door into a limitless realm of experimentation, quantification, and the analysis of an almost infinite number of biological situations, and all of these with the basic objective of understanding cause and effect relationships. Dr. Eugene Odom, the University of Georgia, is a leading exponent of this systems ecology. He recognizes that the stimulus to the development of this new ecology, as it's called, has been both the historical evolution of the discipline, which I've just tried to review, coupled with the modern pressures represented by the exploitation of atomic energy, the exploration of outer space, and the human population explosion. All these latter are obviously related All these latter are obviously related to our needs to meet the challenges posed by problems of man and his environment, man's ability to manipulate his environment well enough to survive well into the future. Essentially, the new ecosystem ecology is the result of shifting emphasis in ecological research from description to function, the search for answers to how, rather than just answers to what, when, or where. And this unit concentration on answering the question how has given limnologists, oceanographers, students of population, terrestrial ecologists a common bond. Although each of them may be working with very different environments and very different organisms, they are now united in seeking answers to similar problems. Such problems as are contained, to quote Odom again, in the study of energetics, species diversity, functional niches, ecological regulation, accompanied by improved analytic, mathematical, and experimental procedures that bring out the common denominators of function. With all the enthusiasm and conviction of evangelists, ecosystem ecologists are certain that they have found in the ecosystem the same kind of common rallying point to unite the environmental biologist that the cell is for the molecular biologist. Dr. Odom has summarized this situation in these words, quote, "It is important to note that many functional principles, such as those relating to the laws of thermodynamics or to metabolism, are the same at all levels of organization. But structure is vastly different at different levels. Therefore, the real difference between levels lies in the interaction of similar functions with differing structures. For example, the biochemical nature of photosynthesis may be the same in a cell as in a forest, but the structure of a forest is so vastly different from the structure of a cell that studies at the cell level do not explain energy fixation, homeostasis, survival, or evolution of a forest." Close quotation. Ecology in this new mold deals with the structure and function of levels of organization beyond the individual. The ecosystem is a life support system functioning within whatever space may be defined or delimited for it, a test tube, a space vehicle, a pond, lake, the ocean, a garden, or the whole earth. Approached as a unit of study and analysis, then, the ecologist considers the ecosystem as a single functional unit, and at the risk of oversimplification, the biological components of that entity are characterized as producers, consumers, decomposers, all such names being descriptive of what the organisms do with energy and raw materials derived directly or indirectly from the physical components of the same system. Trophic or energy levels in the food chain are recognized, and a simple functional outline exists within which all kinds of interrelationships can be identified and analyzed with as high a degree of precision as instrumentation and the imagination of the investigator permit. Obviously, within this concept, the cycling of raw materials, which controls their availability, becomes a very important facet to understand. Energy relationships also come in for increasingly precise delineation in this concept. The community descriptions that formerly represented ends in themselves are now the penultimate objectives of this approach. It is into the matrix of the community that the precise energy raw material data of the ecosystematist must be fitted. Structural patterns of and form differences between species, or even between the sexes of the same species within ecosystems, now stand out as related, possibly, to energy raw material concepts, particularly to their availability of trace materials at critical phases in the ecological life history of the organism. Population fluctuations of one species within the biological components of an ecosystem can be related to concurrent population fluctuations of other species, and the coactions of all are related to the nature and the availability of the life-supporting physical components of that same system. Social relations within communities, between organisms, in the old sense, becomes now a matter to be investigated on the basis of measurable factors. Universal ecological principles that help explain survival or extinction can be hoped for. Ecology as a truly integrative discipline seems to be proceeding along a lucrative pathway, but undoubtedly there will be many questions left for further evolution of the discipline. It may be of interest at this point to return to the title of my talk, The Maturing of a Discipline, and relate a few remarks from a totally different angle. How does a discipline evolve? One way, certainly, is through the influence of research workers and their ideas, through their publications and their forcefulness as individuals in promulgating their philosophy and their conclusions amongst their peers. Another and related way is through the influence of teachers and their ideas, which influence increases in direct proportion to the number of disciples committed to the ideas of the master. These are probably the usual answers to the questions posed. Disciplines have evolved in this simple, straightforward way, with one or several persons appearing on the scene from time to time who are able to command attention and chart the course of the discipline, for a while at least, simply by generalizing about accomplishments to date, by relating seemingly unrelated findings, and by projecting the developments of that discipline into the future. All of this has happened to and within ecology during the last 30 or 40 years. But another dimension has also been added through a means not often used in the academic world of biology. I refer to the activity of our professional societies, in this case, the Ecological Society of America, which established as a group effort an entity known as the Ecology Study Committee. The objectives of this committee are to look critically at the whole area of environmental biology, to determine where it has been and where it is to go, to stimulate interest in those areas that need attention by research workers, and to suggest and advise about the many implications for survival as the universe becomes increasingly a man-dominated ecosystem. The study committee used as its approach to this evolution of the discipline the advantages that come from many minds operating together with the support of a grant from the National Science Foundation and has promoted the writing of books, popular books, the organization of symposia, the collection of bibliographic material not otherwise being collected, and personal contacts with young people going into research teaching careers. It has, in addition, served to advise the council and the membership of our professional society about the responsibility of ecologists in the modern world. Some of the matters, for example, which the study committee has been concerned with in recent years would give you some idea of what it's trying to do. There are gaps in ecological knowledge. There are areas which are not receiving research attention. Some of these which have been recognized and sorted out for emphasis include, and I'll just list a few of them, natural history observations about ecologically important organisms, a search for new and better organisms for laboratory population ecology, the nature of microenvironments, how to measure and describe them, interspecies competition in natural populations, the conditions and importance of rarity in species, natural selection as an identifiable process in nature, the intellectual meaning of long-range ecological surveys, community energetics, environmental physiology, mineral cycling, the effect of environmental pollution, atomic fallout, pesticides, detergents, and that sort of thing. The study committee has also, from time to time, emphasized desirable future developments, which are not necessarily those that are represented simply by the gaps at the present time, such as attention to the construction of models for studying population phenomena, an integration of various approaches to the study of communities to provide the basic data into which the ecosystem philosophy can fit. Greater and more effective use of experimentation in the field. The standardization of microenvironmental measure. The clarification of the subfield of human ecology. And the introduction of rigorous research techniques and objectives into it. The dissemination of current knowledge of basic ecological concepts, the stimulation of young people to go into careers in this field, the development of a closer relation with medical and dental and other health fields in recognizing and helping to resolve the problems of environmental health. Such a committee works hard, inconspicuously, both of which facts were recognized by Dr. Paul B. Sears as he pressed for the establishment of this committee in the years prior to 1958. I cite the deliberate creation by a professional society of a self-study group totally without authority and made up of its own members to accomplish a more rapid evolution of a discipline as an effective means of procedure. It is working in ecology. There remains in the general outline of my remarks, but two more points that I would like to emphasize. Both have to do with the responsibility that comes with maturity. First, there is the matter of the role that ecology can play in education. Ecologists, like the majority of academicians or professionals, talk mostly to each other. Not only that, but in most colleges and universities, ecology is taught only to the students who are already committed. I've recently stated my conviction that ecologists, as teachers, have a special opportunity and responsibility to talk to all students, not just to the relatively few advanced students in the biological sciences who can qualify, or even more important, who, if they can qualify, will elect an advanced biology course that includes appropriate consideration of ecology. I say that ecologists as teachers can rapidly and thoroughly move into leadership roles in the development of courses that become the common experience of all undergraduate students in liberal arts colleges, colleges of arts and sciences. The complexity of interrelationships that ecologists perpetually encounter give them to a singular degree both the perspective to teach interdisciplinarily and to appreciate the unity of knowledge. The education and training that is our method of handing on the intellectual and cultural heritage of mankind from one generation to the next should presumably be complete. Curricula that are devised to educate the youth of our time must include the contributions from the sciences as well as from art, music, philosophy, politics, and so on. Miscellaneous surveys of the sciences often lack meaning when included as a part of general education offerings. Ecology is a unifying and synthesizing discipline among the sciences. It's realistic and objective in its own right, and it is, by its very nature, appealing to the intellect. Ecologists must infiltrate those committees which devise curricula. They must speak loudly and clearly for their discipline. I also have the conviction that in our far-flung American land-grant university system, our colleges of agriculture have an exceptional opportunity at this time to use environmental biology, ecology, to use its principles and its philosophy as the cementing element in a new curriculum that is more natural resource oriented than the traditional one. But to go into that in detail is another story. I stated a while back that I wish to make two points concerning this responsibility that comes to ecologists as a result of the maturing of our discipline. The first were our responsibilities in education, and the second is our responsibility to society. I'm glad to be able to report that perhaps the major accomplishment of the study committee of the Ecological Society of America has been to affect some archaic bylaws just last August, as a matter of fact, which established a committee on public affairs. And through this means, recognized the need for environmental biologists to speak out when economic, social, or political forces conspire to act without professional and expert advice on ecological matters that affect the public interest. Unofficially, and through a subcommittee of the study committee, we ventured a year or so ago, during my term as president of the society, to tell President Kennedy's scientific advisor, as well as other scientific advisors working with the Congress and the legislatures of several states, that we could, if asked, provide the names of persons who could give expert testimony on matters of ecological import. The response from the government, or governments, was immediate and effective. In a dozen or more instances, people were called who helped to add the dimension to legislative and executive decisions that would otherwise have been lacking. The point is here that the very little initiative that it took for a professional group to offer simply to provide the names of people who were expert advisors or witnesses had not previously been taken within and for our discipline. The real evidence of the maturing of ecology may be the development of a felt need by its practitioners to speak for ecology and to relate the scientific scientific principles that relate to man's need to control the ecosystem of which he is a part. I will conclude my remarks with a quotation from Dr. Stanley A. Kane at the University of Michigan, who has been the exponent for many years of the proper attention that should be given to human ecology within our study group for several years. We can extend the concept of ecosystem to include man. And here the ecosystem has a wholly new dimension provided by man himself that distinguishes his ecology from that of any other species and that makes his ecosystem embarrassingly complex. Because of man's cultural characteristics, he has a capacity for reactions and coactions that make him the most dynamic and effective element of his own ecosystem. And yet, for all his power, he is an inextricable part of the total ecosystem and ultimately cannot escape from the operation of ecological laws. This fact, however, men frequently do not realize or refuse to face in their attempts to conquer nature rather than to discover means of cooperating with her.
Perhaps the great lesson to be derived from the history of ecological research is that man's future must be found in harmonious adjustment to his ecosystem if he is to perpetuate a situation within which he can remain dominant and not suffer defeat for his arrogance before nature. The various human ecosystems, then, consist not only of the biotic world of which men are a part and the physical aspects of their surroundings, such as climate, topography, and soils, but include also the complicated set of interhuman coactions that are more or less institutionalized in law, economics, politics, social vehicles, social psychology, and so forth. In short, culture, in the broadest sense of the term, is perhaps the most important set of factors in the human ecosystem. Thank you very much.